Index investing or passive investing has grown more popular with investors. Even Warren Buffett touts the benefits of owning an entire index like the S&P 500 over the long term. An example of an index tracking ETF is BMO's S&P 500 Index ETF. It's the largest ETF in Canada that tracks this well-recognized and popular index. It provides exposure to the returns of the market cap-weighted S&P 500 index at a low cost, the management fee of just 0.08%. This broad market ETF makes for an efficient building block in a portfolio, saving you time and effort while mitigating single stock risk. If you're looking for exposure to the largest and most liquid public companies in the United States, this ETF delivers an easy-to-use solution and instant diversification. Commissions and management fees and expenses all may be associated with investments in exchange-traded funds. Please read the ETF facts or prospectus of the BMO ETFs before investing.
Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that this information discussed today is not intended to be or construed as investment advice. Please consult a professional advisor before putting a loony in any of these financial markets.
The dirty secret is that no one's ever going to get paid back.
People have the shortest memories when it comes to investment.
We just got to get Keith into Bitcoin.
Hey, there's a bubble.
Welcome back to Loony Hour, episode 126. As always, join me the three amigos. We've got Keith Dicker, Ice Cap Asset Management, Rich Diaz, PGM. What's going on, fellas? Keith, what's going on? Lots of hustle and bustle in the background.
Yeah, I know. The office looks a bit different today, doesn't it? Different than you've seen before.
Looks pretty good. What are you drinking?
Well, for those who are not watching, we're down in the Mexico area with family and stuff. So I'm at some fancy resort, and you know what? I'm at the swim-up bar right now. So that's where we're doing the recording from today.
You pissing
it's
it?
It's very important. You have to stay hydrated all the time, Rich. So you need your drinks to stay hydrated. But that's what I'm doing here for a few days.
For those,
I don't even know what it's called.
Someone's gonna make fun of you. I will say this: you were drinking a beer before you were drinking that girly drink.
Well, I have one of those too, so you have both going. But that's what we're doing here. What about you, Rich? What do you got going on?
Are you actually in the swim-up bar?
He's actually in the swim-up bar.
That's hilarious. All right, that's a first for the Loony Hour. There you go.
Mercifully, he has his shirt on.
Do they dye the color of the water when you pee?
next one. No, it's that's fun, guys. It's a nice place. It's right on the sea. This place is really nice. And I got to go meet up with Mrs. Ice Cap later. She's down hanging out here.
How about that peso?
The peso, I know.
Peso's strong, man.
Peso's very strong.
Yeah, it is strong. But what do you have going on there, Rich? What's new in Montreal?
It's beautiful, magic day. I'm working from home, so I can laugh at your silly jokes. Unencumbered, and I'm gonna go for a run, which is a big deal for me because I haven't run in a long time. But it's gotta stay in shape.
Can't think of anything else I'd rather not do than run.
So I'm gonna work from home. I'm actually quite productive here. I have to take back a lot of the vitriol I had about people working from home. I thought it's mostly just a scam, but it's pretty good most of the time. So I'm gonna work and then go for gym. But man, let's get into it. There's so much stuff going on, and I know Keith's got a Keith's gonna can't stay away from Mrs. Ice Cap too long. So,
I have a water poolside aerobics coming up soon. So it's and I'm in the seniors category as well. So I'm in. I fit right in.
Yeah, you stick fitness. Around. You stick around long enough, the shirt might come off.
That's right.
We had a pretty busy week. We had the BOC. Everyone was waiting. I think we had a Twinkie bet on it, but not much happened there. It was kind of a as expected rate hold from the BOC. I did watch his press conference. I don't know if you guys did, but it seemed kind of hawkish. Tiff Macklem really pushed back on the notion of rate cuts coming sooner than expected. I mean, basically the overwhelming message that I got from him was that, Rich, something you've highlighted quite a bit is core inflation. And he's like, listen, core is what we're watching. I think they talk about trim and medium CPI. Trim and what was the other one?
There's three. There's the three preferred measures of core CPI. It's like a factor model, a GDP model, and trim model. But
he basically was rambling off those three and saying, listen, they're still kind of in the mid threes. And there's no rush to be prematurely cutting rates. So for those that are in the housing market, which we'll get into because we've got a lot of data and mortgage stats and delinquency information that's happening there, we'll kind of get into that.
Yeah, I thought it was a good press conference, to be honest. I think I've been very, very critical of Tiff Macklem's, lack of independence in the past, certainly during COVID. But to his credit, he was like every question, it seems like it's just some, permutation on when are you going to cut rates? Can you please cut rates now? Why haven't you already cut rates?
Just suffocating on their variable, exactly. Right now.
And I felt like for a really, he's quite demure and passive in some ways, but he was like, I think getting exasperated. And like basically asking people for patience. Two things that I took away from. One is he said 45% of the CPI basket is still rising above 3%. And he said, we won't be lowering rates at the pace we raised them, which I thought was two very, very important points. One is to reiterate what you said, Steve, which is the breadth of inflation is still too high for that. And then two, even if you do get a cut, I really don't think it's going to be as fast or as. And that's exactly right, the pace. So, that's it for me. I don't know, Keith, if you had anything to take away from that.
Well, I think the same thing is happening about we've been discussing for a while. I think people's expectations for sharp rate cuts, it's way too sharp. You know, as I said, like they were at 125 basis points at the end of December. Now it's probably less than 75 now, Rich.
Yeah, I can check quickly.
You know, it might be somewhere in between, right? 65 or 70, something like that. Mm-hmm. But we have to be prepared for this economy that I suspect it's still going to decline and roll over. And at the same time, though, inflation data can stay a bit funny, and that's going to give them put them in a real hard spot, because if they cut rates, helps the housing market and fires everything back up again. But the other conversation that doesn't get a lot of attention is on the fiscal side. So I think we're going to get an update to Canada's fiscal position this week or next week. I think that's
it was in April.
It's in April. It's in April. It's delayed.
Man, you're really
on
vacation.
How long have I been down here for now? I don't even remember.
Hey, you know what's funny? Keith, go ahead. I'll let you finish that sentence.
Well, I have a more deeper pride. What are you going
to
say?
Well, it's funny enough, like a reporter actually asked Tiff Macklem in that interview period, and she said, you know, the federal government is coming out with their budget announcement in April. And I think the BOC's rate announcement for April is like several days before the federal government releases their budget update. And she said, how are you able to make a monetary decision without having that information readily available? Like, how are you going to navigate this? And he kind of just dodged the question. But I thought it is a good question, right? I mean, how do you set monetary policy if you don't know what's happening on the fiscal side?
Well, I think we do know what's happening on the fiscal side. Yeah. I don't think there's going to be, what was their estimate? Around a $40 billion deficit? I think the number is probably going to be maybe 45-ish or something. Like I saw some studies this week.
I'll go higher.
A little bit higher, yeah. But the point is, though, you know, and the same thing's happening with the Americans as well. You know, despite all the tightening of monetary policy, the fiscal side has been enough to offset it or even more. And it doesn't work. So as long as the fiscal side here, as long as Ottawa continues to spend a lot more than what they're taking in tax revenue, and that's absolutely going to be the case, you know, again, you got to look at the probability that Bank of Canada, they do not cut rates at all. Like, again, it doesn't mean they're going to hike, mind you, because the next move will be down, but it could take a long time for it to happen, or longer than what's expected. And maybe the degree of it won't be as much either. But you got to start focusing on the fiscal side. And you're going to, you know, when they have that update now, you're going to see the suggestion for tax increases coming in. You know, you got to tax the wealthy. You know, Rich, you always have a good view on that, of course. Like, even I think even Biden is going to touch on that now with the, did he do the State of the Union address yet?
No, that is going to be a very interesting speech.
Yeah, but he's going to, you know, the whole concept, you know, with, you know, on the fiscal side, you have tax revenues coming in and then your expenses going out. And of course, you know, the government response, well, let's tax the rich. And, you know, the rich are not making their money on taxable income. You know, they're making it on asset growth, which gets, you know, we've seen that this week again with markets of all kind. So, you know, I think here in Ottawa, you're going to see Ottawa saying, yeah, we're going to tax the, you know, really wealthy companies again, you know, people making a lot of money. And there will be no whispers whatsoever of cutting spending. Because, Steve, you can't cut spending now, Steve, because the economy is slowing. But yet they weren't cutting spending when it was growing either. So, well, you know, it's
Keith, people are struggling due to inflation, so you can't cut spending.
It's a joke. It's a joke. I mean, Canadians are one of the highest tax jurisdictions in the world. I think it's important that people remember that. We have the highest effective tax rate. We're taxed on virtually everything minus breathing. And I'm sure if they can figure that out, they would do. So when you compare countries like on the OECD, you can just Google this, by the way. Just Google effective tax rate OECD and you get a table. And Canada's always, always at the top of this table. And it's not clear, by the way, our services are improving commensurate with those rising taxes. So I don't know, Steve. I'm not happy about it.
Did you see that? You know, I got to give this guy a bit of credit. I mean, Derek Holt at Scotiabank. So he was like, again, he was the first guy that came out at the end of 2021 and said the BOC is going to have to hike rates 8 times. In 2022. Yeah. And I did chirp him at the time. I said, that's crazy. There's no way that they're going to be able to do that. And, you know, he was the most aggressive economist that was forecasting that by like a country mile. And of course, you know, we know that what happened was we got more than 8 rate hikes. But since then he's been really,
so
just...
he was wrong, Steve, to be clear, he was wrong.
No, yeah, no.
But I mean, at least he aired on
We were wrong. We were wrong.
We were more
that.
Wrong. We were more wrong. Yeah. Absolutely.
He's been like, but he's like, for an economist, I feel like he's really like at a big bank economist. I feel like he's kind of really stepped out and kind of pushed the envelope about what you can publicly say as a big bank salaried employee. And, you know, he wrote a note this week again, and he's been pounding the table on interest rates throughout this whole hiking cycle, saying, listen, they got to keep going. They can't stop. And so he wrote a piece this week and he says, in a bigger sense, I'm deeply worried about public policy in my country. Productivity is in a tailspin. A greater share of GDP is spent on here today, gone tomorrow, current spending by governments and households than in decades. Tax policy is uncompetitive. Business bashing has become commonplace by people who've never spent 2 seconds working in private industry. Competition policy changes face serious criticisms here. Changes to labor laws have benefited unions while collective bargaining exercises are driving wage growth to the moon despite collapsing productivity. Major sectors of the economy are literally being taken over by government, with recent examples being childcare, dental care, and now pharmacare. Do we get better quality outcomes in state-run health and education sectors? Have you tried visiting an ER lately? Enough said. So that's, again, from a big bank economist to come out with that commentary. Clearly, he's tuning into the Loony Hour. We share a lot of similar views there. But if he's listening, Derek, I want to give you a little bit of props there.
Life is rough, though, guys.
Wow.
I mean, we obviously agree with Derek.
But
there's a lot of truthiness with what Derek was saying with that, you know, and, you know, we've been touching on it, you know, a little bit, and so a lot of other places as well. And, you know, it gets masked. What's the word? It is covered over a lot with the population growth that's coming in. And I, you know, there's a long fix to this for Canada. That's what they're trying to do. But I don't think they'll get to the end of that long road without a crisis first. And I continue to expect that's where we're going. Because you got to stop the housing crisis. And how do you do that? It's not on the supply side, because you're going to bring in like an army of carpenters and tradespeople to do it, right? It just doesn't work out. And, you know, government, they don't have the the confidence, you know, to just stop immigration growth, you know, from day one. You can't do that. So, you know, Derek is right. And that there's a real battle brewing. I know the Bank of Canada gets a lot of attention, but I, you know, I'll continue. I'm going to shift the attention here back to Ottawa because that's where it should be. And it should be on the fiscal spending side and all the craziness that's happening over there.
Yeah, I want to actually pull on. Go ahead, Rich.
Well, I was just going to say it's all related. And Keith's right about the Ottawa, the policy, whether it's productivity, which Mr. Hull alluded to, population growth affects shelter, which affects inflation, which is also, you know, it's why productivity is important. If you have a bump in productivity, that's disinflationary. And the opposite's true. If your productivity growth is very, very poor, that's inflationary. And so, you know, there's a lot of pressure on Tiff Macklem, and I think he rightly pushed back on this idea that we need to cut. But I think Keith's right, and I think Mr. Holt's right. But Steve, go ahead.
No, yeah, I want to pull on a few threads of kind of what Mr. Holt said, and kind of what we're trying to sort of summarize here is the precarious state of the country right now, which is okay. You know, inflation's still a little bit elevated. It's not quite time to cut, but we do have. There's a lot of things that are happening under the surface that I think there's clear signs of some pain that it's emerging. You know, we've talked about it last week in the episode, which was, you know, six consecutive quarters of declining real GDP per capita in this country. And then you look at it, you know, we had some data out this week showing business insolvencies in Canada running at their highest level since 2006. I mean, that just doesn't paint this picture that everything is fine. I don't know.
Yeah, that must be a lot of small businesses, though. Is it, Steve? What's the size of the companies? And it's, you know, that's the saddest part about it. You know, they're usually family run business, people putting their own money in. You know, they're not raising equity from shareholders and stuff.
Yeah, no, it's just business insolvencies. It doesn't.
No, but it will be smaller businesses. They just have a higher birth death rate, which is what they're called. I mean, it's quite a morbid way of calling it, but right. That's what companies call. That's what economists call birth for when you have a new company, a death rate. When
because
you have an old company.
A lot of these companies, you know, say there's a lot of retail stuff going on. You know, they probably reach the max of price increases. You know, there's only so much you can. Like restaurants struggle, right? Like that's a real. Yeah. As you look at, but yet their costs continue to get squeezed, so their margins are falling. It's a real tough position we're in. And I like the, you know, there were, I think one of us tweeted out recently, you know, it was showing a comparison between a government worker and a private sector worker.
Yeah.
And one of my dear friends, he's on the public sector side, and he politely pointed out he was making 8.5% more than other people. It was kind of funny. But, you know, people don't realize that it is a productivity problem we're having here in Canada. And to be less productive, it doesn't mean you're not working as hard. It just means that the outcome, the leverage, the efficiency that you're getting from that energy that's going in is declining. And that's why our growth per capita and, you know, all these data points are coming down. People like to say, hey, it's a negative show we're putting here. But we're just showing people and positioning them to better appreciate. These are the real conversations that take place at the Bank of Canada, you know, in Ottawa, you know, the big think tanks. This is the exact same thing they're talking about. They're not as funny as, you know, as Rich, of course, but it is the same concepts that they're looking at.
We calls it like we sees it. I mean, the reality is you have, this is the problem when you have a massive, massive speculative bubble in real estate. And when red tape and productivity lacks in other sectors, because you feel like there's a huge inflow into this non-productive asset. Sorry, Steve. And when interest rates go up, people have to allocate more money to servicing that debt, which is effectively a balance sheet recession, which is what I believe we're in. I've said this for months now. But the other side of that is that that capital, instead of being allocated to productive assets, and what do I mean by productive assets? I mean machinery, equipment, non-residential structures, so CapEx or gross fixed capital formation, ex residential. And if you look at those numbers, whether it's non-residential structures, we'll share the chart, and machinery and equipment, they're declining. And other countries, again, US, again, deficit spending, yes, you might hate it if you want, But that those numbers are going through the roof. The manufacturing in and even Mexico, where you are in, the spending on manufacturing and equipment is going through the roof. In America, it's going through the roof. And in Canada, it's moribund. And unless you have those kinds of things, you'll never improve your productivity growth, which will keep inflation sticky, and around we go. But Steve, I don't know if you want to add to
that. Well, yeah, I mean, there's also the, on the business insolvency side, I think there's a bunch of these pandemic business loans were actually having to start being repaid. And I think it was in January. So I feel like there's probably still a lot more coming down the pipe here where our business is actually going to be able to pay back these pandemic loans that they took on. And what is the delayed impact of that moving forward? So, Rich, you'll like this one, but private sector payrolls in Canada have declined over the past 6 months. This is the first time it's happened since the pandemic lockdowns, and prior to that, the financial crisis. So, you know, I mean, that's got to be a major recessionary signal. I don't know if it's on the Bank of Canada's radar or not, but I think when we talk about the future direction of monetary policy, that could be a twist.
There's one more thing on the insolvencies, which is, I remember now, a client told me this actually from a meeting about a year ago. In the UK, you had a huge fill up in insolvencies. And his quip to me in the meeting was, yeah, he didn't buy it because he thinks that like a lot of people created businesses to then go with their hand out for all this COVID money. And as soon as the COVID money dried up, instead of repaying the money, they just went belly up and made their company insolvent. So in the UK, you can see the same sort of jump, and it's not, and even though there's been employment growth and there's been all this other stuff going on. So I think the jury's still out on that data point.
Okay. Well, on another data point we can debate here, we have a significant rise in mortgage delinquencies as well.
Yeah, that's different.
Yeah. So there was some data that came out from Equifax that shows the jump in mortgage delinquencies. And so you had the numbers, obviously, of course, they look staggering from a headline perspective. You know, they're up 135% year over year in Ontario, 62% in BC. So that the rate of change is, Rich, definitely concerning. But when you put the numbers in a little bit more context, there's about 5 million mortgages in Canada, 5 million residential mortgages. Right now, we have about 10,000 of those that are delinquent. So your national arrears rate in Canada is 0.18%. So it's very, very low. It's coming off all-time record lows. So we've based, clearly we're heading up higher. Clearly mortgage delinquencies are a lagging indicator. These are only going to grow. I have no doubt about that. But the overall absolute number is still incredibly low.
Okay.
Keith, I don't know if there's anything that you're watching on that end in particular, but I do have a couple more stories that I think are worth sharing on the pod here.
Well, it sort of ties into the overriding themes that, you know, credit spreads have been extremely tight. So by definition, you can't get any better. You know, it's kind of what you just shared then, Steve, as well. But something I want to jump into, I don't know if it's a different subject completely, with private credit, or do you want to link that in with this?
Yeah, let me finish this thread on the mortgage market. I think, Rich, you've talked about it before, but like the power that the big five banks have in this country to manage
them.
to manage, or at least try to manage, a crisis is unbelievable. And you kind of have to be in the industry now, like obviously, like I have these conversations quite regularly, that you really see the ability of these banks to keep loans looking good or solvent. So I'll give you a couple examples. As we know, there's a huge chorus of Canadian banks that have what we call negative amortization. So there's three banks in particular that allow this sort of product. It's BMO, CIBC, TD. Those are like the big three that allow negative amortizations. And so roughly, as per the latest earnings report, it's about 15% of their mortgage portfolio is negative amortizing. So what does that mean? It basically means you have a cohort of people, about 15% of people that have borrowed money, their amortizations are growing And not only that, but in a lot of circumstances, they're not actually paying all the interest on their monthly loan. So the interest is actually just being tacked onto the balance, in which they'll have to repay upon, you know, mortgage renewal or when that comes up. Now, I've heard stories recently of, you know, situations where clients, for example, have been negative amortizing, right? So they're clearly sort of behind, but the banks are kind of extending and pretending these type of loans and incurring credit card debt, for example, having large credit card debt, and basically then consolidating these loans, these credit card debts, into a larger mortgage, basically. And it's like, well, how could you do that? The bank allowed you to take on a larger mortgage when you're already in a negative amortization situation. Like, by many accounts, like, you're kind of already kind of delinquent. Like, and so the banks are allowing. So like that's number one. And that's like, okay, like, this is how you manage like these crises. Like, and number two, we have what we call, like, the other thing that I find very, very interesting is we have what we call blanket appraisals. So you've heard a lot of people talking about this in Twitter and everything where, okay, you know, there's all these pre-sale condos. They were bought at the peak, you know, 3 years ago. Now they're coming up for completion. They're all underwater. That's definitely an exaggeration, but there's definitely a decent cohort of people that are underwater, right? And so the question is always like, you know, are people going to be able to get mortgages for them? You know, what are the values, right? So for example, like, let's just say you bought a pre-sale condo for 1.5, but any sophisticated realtor will be able to run the numbers and tell you, well, listen, it's kind of only worth 1.2. What we're seeing is a lot of banks are doing what they call these blanket appraisals, which is like they basically have set appraisals on these properties where it doesn't matter if the values have dropped, they'll still loan you on the value of the 1.5 million. So even though, and I've heard of stories and transactions, these aren't like stories, like I heard it from like four people. Like, so no, it's like these are like concrete stories out in the field where someone will like literally assign it for, let's say, you know, they bought it for 1.5, they sign it for 1.2 because they can't afford to close on the property. So they just assign it. They take a $300,000 loss. They forfeit all their deposits. The new buyer closes at 1.2, but then goes to the bank and gets a loan based on a 1.5 value.
Oh, God.
So the bank is writing loans on a lot of these pre-sale projects that are effectively underwater from day one. And so that's why you don't have like this massive wave of defaults on pre-sale projects, people not being able to complete. So if you want to ask yourselves like why Canada's kind of in this situation, why we have really high house prices, low delinquencies, and, you know, seemingly this idea that there's no risk out there, is because the big five Canadian banks, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes of how to manage this. And you think about it on the flip side, is like, we're like, whoa, how can they do those blanket appraisals? Well, like, let's be honest. Oftentimes, and they claim they don't communicate, but oftentimes the bank's commercial lending team is on the construction side of that project.
Yeah. A syndicated loan. All five of them would be, or whatever. Right?
They're incentivized to get that across the finish line. So anyways, that's what happens like real time in the market. So
But Canadian banks are invincible. You're the smartest, Rich. Don't laugh. About 15 years ago, they were ranked as the second smartest bankers in the world. That's true. The second. And then they've been number one.
Who created that study? That's impressive.
The Icelandic bankers were number one.
Yes, I remember this.
Yeah, but then they fell out of the league. They got demoted down. So that's why the Canadians are there. And, you know, as people will always point out to me, hey, you know, the Canadian banks are outstanding. They always increase their dividend. They've never failed you and stuff like that. And that's true. However, that's linear thinking. And that's been a period with 40 years of rates always going down with, you know, debt going higher because of lower rates. Now, as Steve, you're pointing out, we're in a period where rates are going higher. Loans, borrowing is still going higher, but yet the equity behind a lot of these loans have basically, you know, been vaporized.
Yeah, like legitimately, these are underwater loans, but they just...
So you saw this week, I think the CIBC CEO stepped down.
I didn't see that, no.
Yeah. You know, he did his 10-year stint. That's normally what happens with the Canadian bankers. And I read it and I said, oh man, good on you. You got out just in time.
they massively underperformed there too. And did they not? CIBC has been a bit of a train wreck.
Yeah.
How long it's
always been. Like, hey, let's not feel bad for these guys. You know, they're in a business where they're levered. Right, they have no real competition, and they go, "Oh yeah, no, that's not true." It is true, and you know they got a pretty good setup. So I wouldn't feel too bad for any of these senior bankers.
It's a great business. There's five or six banks in an economy that's, you know, 40 million people plus. It's brilliant. But I have a question, Steve. How long do you think this can last, given nominal GDP growth supported by population, given the regulatory sort of tailwind that, you know, closing their eyes to kind of the more nefarious practice? How long do you think this can last? Because that's the thing about these practices.
You've had people talking about the housing crash, right, in Canada since what, 2005? I mean,
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, it's definitely gone on like longer than I thought it would. I mean, I think there's been a lot of short bets on Canadian housing, Canadian banks, that of course, you know, has been the widow maker trade. It's definitely unsustainable, but it just, you know, trying to get the timing of like a once in a generational type of crises potentially is obviously difficult. I mean, seeing what I'm seeing, you know, people forget, like, it was the pandemic, wasn't that long ago. I mean, nearly 20% of Canadians were deferring their mortgage payments. Yeah. Canadian banks gave, like, basically anyone and everyone that asked for a payment relief holiday, they granted it. 6 months, don't pay your mortgage. Don't worry about it. No penalty.
So, but they, like, had to, though, right? Because if they didn't, they would have had to mark them down on their books.
And, well, can you not say the same thing with these negative amortizing mortgages? I mean, like, let's call it what it is. Like, I don't want to say it's like delinquent, but like, it's a non-performing loan. Like, you're not paying all of your interest.
Yeah.
Your balance is growing.
I totally agree with you. I mean, that's what I said a couple weeks ago. I totally agree with you.
They just kind of keep, like, it's basically you just keep moving the goalposts. It's like, we'll just change this over there, and, like, you know, we'll give this guy a longer amortization, and, like, I don't know. It is what it is. At the end of the day, like, I always, you know, make this comment, which is like, your house is the bank's asset. That's their collateral. So it's like,
this is the conversation that, you know, it's a high level conversation, and we're having it, of course, you know, and I think we're hitting it, you know, from all sides and angles. This ain't a good situation for the economy.
No.
And it doesn't mean it has to blow up or anything. It just means that, boy, we better not hit a true recession. That's all it is right now. If we do hit one, you know, what are they going to do with it? How much further out will they, you know, put a negative amortization on these mortgages outstanding?
I don't know what the answer is.
And that's with people with jobs. Imagine if that person loses their job, right?
Yeah. And I would say, like, you know, in general, you know, you look at the housing market today, we didn't really touch too much on the stats. You know, we got some February numbers out, like, it's moving. It's fine. It's just a very hit or miss market. But, you know, things are transacting. Prices are quite sticky. They've barely budged really from the peak. So all things considered, like, and a lot of that's because you've had this, like, huge drop off in new listings inventory to market, which has kind of kept the valuations higher. So yeah, I would say so far, you know, considering how many, like, mortgages are negative amortizing, like, it's been kind of like a managed crisis so far.
But the answer the solution for it is something that you brought up before. I think, Steve, was it, I think, earlier today or last week, we need, and Rich is touching on it as well, we need to attract foreign investment into the country. And if everyone understand, a dollar that's invested into the country, that's different than government borrowing to spend. That's just debt. It pays out as income. It's not productive. It's not creating something. Because when you create an asset, it grows over time. It's not like you spend a dollar, then it's gone. But if we start to attract more foreign investment into the country, and, you know, it doesn't matter what the industry is going to be, but if you do that, then that will be a solid return for the economy. And then that could help us, you know, smooth out this, you know, in my opinion, it's a high probability event, but that's what we need to do. I'm not quite sure that's happening because you guys have seen some data points.
Well, yeah.
So just, I mean, the opposite, you know, foreign investment is leaving. So
foreign investors sold a net $48 billion worth of Canadian equities in 2023. That's the largest annual outflow on record ever for Canada. That's data compiled by BMO Economics. So, you know, I mean, in terms of foreign investment coming into the country, like, clearly foreign capital is not interested in investing in Canadian businesses. And so I just think there's a bigger underlying story here, Rich, that is concerning, when, especially when you tie it in with what we're seeing on the Canada pension plan side, which we'll get into.
I think you have to be careful about that, though. I think that's too strong. I think the idea that, I think what matters is on, you know, I guess I'm going to speak on both sides of my mouth here, but it's too strong because Canada is one of the largest economies in the world. We are. We are a huge weight in the MSCI world. So that's the global equity index. And if you allocate, if you're a huge pension fund in Japan and you want to allocate money to MSCI World, which would be your benchmark, Canada's a non-trivial sum of that. I think that the problem is at the margin, we're becoming less and less and less attractive as a place to invest for a number of reasons, which, you know, it's kind of boring to go over them over and over again, but, like, you know, red tape, lack of productivity growth, lack of competition in really key sectors, banking, oil, telecoms, grocery, et cetera. And so and people basically, you know, investors are just trying to maximize their return and minimize their risk. And at the margin, I think Canada is becoming a less attractive place to invest. Why would you invest in Canada? Would you go invest in Mexico or the United States, where growth is better, there's less debt? You know, the US having less debt, that's, you know, Keith and I can argue about that some other time. My point is, at the margin, I think Canada is becoming less.
You need to compare Canada to the G7, not to Mexico or Brazil or anyone. Let's be fair.
Yeah. But so I think that's it. So to say it's not an attractive destination, I think is wrong. We have laws, we have a regulatory environment that, you know, you will get your capital back versus China that you might not. So, but in general, I agree with you, Steve, that at the margin, it's deteriorating for sure.
So there's another story that's been brewing here all over the news, which is potentially forcing, the federal government's trying to force basically pension funds here in Canada to invest in Canadian equities. So there's been dozens of top business leaders recently signing a letter urging federal and provincial finance ministers to alter the rules governing pension funds in order to boost the amount that they invest in Canada. So, for example, in the year 2000, they point out that publicly traded Canadian companies made up 28% of the assets of domestic pension funds. Last year, that proportion fell to 4%. So clearly, Canadian pension funds are divesting away from Canadian companies and putting that money elsewhere. And so, Keith, I'm kind of curious your thoughts here, because to me that is a little bit concerning that, you know, you're dictating the flows of, you know, a pension fund, which has a fiduciary responsibility to seek out, you know, a return to the pensioners that they are responsible for taking care of, right? So, like, I don't know, like, would that be like them saying, hey, Mr. Ice Cap, you run, you know, a portfolio management business, but, you know, you can't invest this much in the U.S. You got to take an allocation and deploy it here in Canada.
Yeah, a couple of points. First point is my battery is going close to zero here. So it doesn't mean I fell off the swim up bar stool. Which, Rich, you were just floating around, right? You wouldn't hurt yourself. but it's a really good question, Steve, because, you know, I mean, if the Canadian government responds to try to attract more domestic capital to stay in the economy, you don't mandate it. Instead, you create the environment that will encourage them to invest there. That's why money is flowing. Money will always flow to the economy where you can make the most money for it, the amount of risk that you take, and you can get your money back So me, I remember when I first started the business, you were only allowed to have, I think, 18% in foreign investments in your RSPs and pension funds. And then they raised it to 20 and then 22. And then eventually they just took the handcuffs off. But for the government response to say, hey, we need to start investing back into Canada. Again, that it just clearly, it just screams that policymakers are failing with our governments. Yes, we're talking to you guys. You need to do things better. A lot of these like nonsensical policies, the policies that you've adopted over the last 8 years, that's a great example. You know, Rich knows a lot of them, but you can't force people to invest where they shouldn't be because, you know, your fiduciary duty gets destroyed. And so what happens then, Steve, if they put all the money back in Canada, you know, to be dramatic about it, and it doesn't grow, yet the liabilities continue to fly,
exactly.
You know, our deficit flies, the Canadian dollar gets slammed, the bond market gets crushed. All of a sudden, the asset growth you may have had by being elsewhere is what, 20, 30, 40% less? Meanwhile, your liabilities have more than doubled.
So
it's,
yeah, there's
it's not a good, it's not a good solution.
Well, it's an interesting stat there. We get to like returns, right? I mean, so in order to obviously hit the returns that the Canada Pension Plan needs, right, is they need obviously new money coming in to pay out, you know, the retirees, the boomers, et cetera. So if you look at the CPP contribution rate, which is basically how much, you know, capital is being allocated off of, you know, for example, paychecks towards, you know, the Canada Pension Plan, you know, 1970, it was 3.6%. So 3.6%. Today, it's 11.9%. So obviously, you know, for corporations, for companies that have to pay, you know, their salaried employees, obviously they have to have, you know, a portion of that. They have to pay out CPP. They have to pay out. That's basically a tax on your business, on your revenues. And so it's now at 11.9%. So, you know, begs the question, right? At what pace is, you know, if the returns aren't that great, and you go from 11.9 to, you know, maybe in 7 years, you're at 14.9, then you're at 20.9. But
Steve, yeah. can we take one step back here? So like, just so people understand, what they're asking is for pension funds, which are allocators of public, mostly public capital. They do make private investments. Let's just say for argument's sake, it's their public allocation funds. So stock markets, et cetera. What they want to do is they want to allocate more capital to the Canadian equity market. Well, guess what the Canadian equity market is? 35% of the Canadian equity market is financials. And I bet you can name all six of those companies. The largest holding in the MSCI Canada basket is Royal Bank. Toronto Dominion is number two. Shopify, okay, tech company. So that's it. The second largest is the energy sector. But at the same time that they want us to allocate more money to domestic, 18% of the Canadian equity market is the energy sector. Guess what the government is trying to do? Destroy the energy sector in Canada. So that's one piece of it. It's like, what are they? So who stands to benefit from that allocation of capital? The banks, energy companies, and then of course there's the consumer staples. We know who they are. They're the big grocery stores. Then there's the telecom industry, that we know who they are. Do you know what I mean? So it's just basically the 6 or 10 companies are probably like leaning on these politicians to allocate domestically, basically to give them a cheaper cost of capital, which is bogus. That's the first thing. Second thing is that the Canadian economy is financials and energy have been massively underperforming the global equity market, which has been dominated by tech. There's no tech in Canada except for one or two companies. And then there's some consumer discretionary stocks. You know them, LVHM, Amazon, et cetera, all these other companies, JD out of China, you know, whatever. And Canada has massively, massively underperformed the global equity market since the peak of the oil boom in 2010 or 2009 or whatever it was. So the fact that these pension funds have not been allocating to Canada, thank God, we would have been getting absolutely killed. And Keith's point about the liability asset mismatch would be in our face. So now, if you want to make the argument that Canada is so cheap and so unloved as a sector that you want to buy energy companies because they trade at 1x book value and they have huge dividends and blah, blah, blah. Okay, I could make that a case. But for a wholesale shift of all of our pension funds to be allocated to an equity market that's massively overweight banks and massively overweight energy in an environment where no one wants to support the energy sector. And massive, like, that's fucking nuts. What, these people have never used the internet. That's my only way. Like,
it's one of Rich's best rants yet, I think, Steve.
Anyways,
that was a good one.
Yeah, sorry. And he's 100%. He is 100% correct. So anyone listening to this who can't affect policy, you know, have a better consideration of what Rich just said.
Just like use maybe the internet. It's like what I would say.
Maybe they should be taking a little bit of Bitcoin there, Keith. What do you think, buddy?
I know if they put everything there, they would have been doing a lot better. That's for sure.
So nuts. New all-time highs, not only in Canadian dollars, but in USD for our Bitcoin followers here that are angry in the comment section that we never talk about Bitcoin.
That's right.
That's two plugs in back-to-back episodes now you guys. The crypto bull market is in full force, and I am enjoying that right now. I might bring back my laser eyes.
I think you have to. Is that
no,
is
that no, no, don't. That will be the top of the market again. Yeah, as soon as I see those red eyes out again, you know, it's the top. So guys, my battery is draining here dramatically. Do you have any more, you know, questions for the boomer before he goes to
wow, yeah, a little early pool, Mai Tai.
The pool yoga I have to do next.
Well, I mean, curious your thoughts on the Japan market there. Also, the Nikkei hitting all-time highs. I mean, it took a long time to get back, but they made it.
It's kind of like the Bitcoin chart in a way, which is compressed and expanded with the x-axis.
Well,
no one? Not even Rich got that one.
What? No.
A funny thing with an economy and its financial markets, when an economy is starting to decline, when the current, what I should say is, you can have a currency depreciating significantly, the local equity market should rise. You will always get that situation happening, and then same with the opposite as well. You can have the currency strengthening and the equities will come off. So I know it's taken a while, you know, for the Japanese equity market, you know, to sort of recapture the glory days from, what was the high, late 80s, early 90s?
Oh God, I had it, and then I'll get it.
You lost the chart.
The high.
Yeah, when was it?
Drum roll.
1989, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. 1989. Of course, the real estate bubble imploded too. But yeah,
that was my guess. That was a guess.
It's not something that, you know, it's really awesome.
Yeah, it was 89. It was December of 89.
So, but just say though, we go into an environment coming up, right? And it sort of comes back to the whole pension conversation. And this will turn everything upside down here. Well, Boomer said this. If we do run into a crisis here up there in Canada, yeah, say the Canadian dollar comes down hard, equity should go higher.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, it won't mean you won't be able to wrap your head around it. You're like, wait, why is that?
You won't
happening?
Be able to go to Mexico and have a nice vacation, but
yeah. But you could be, for example, you know, as a foreign investor, just say you're invested in, you know, Canadian equities, you know, because you did it. And just say equity markets go up 20% and then the currency is down 20, you know, it's a break even kind of. Again, like the currency side is very important. That's all I'm making out here.
Boomer, you got to get going, buddy.
Yeah, I do have to go. One very quick thing here, and I might drop dead here in this. No, I won't drop. Sorry, the line might cut off here when I'm doing it.
We hope you don't drop dead.
and I resist from scratching my leg. They're all because, you know, I'm at a swim with burn. I just did it. My hand is now wet, so I can't touch the computer. But guys, continue to watch this private credit market that we've been talking about for quite some time. And now I saw some stories now this week. That's what I'm reading this morning. So companies who are incredibly unprofitable, they're issuing debt, you know, they're not issuing a bond that, you know, you can buy on the market anywhere, but they're issuing private credit, is being gobbled up, is then being securitized, right? Like a mortgage-backed security, asset-backed security is being sold off. Guess who's buying this stuff?
I don't know.
You with your pension fund.
What? Are they pensions pretty active in that right now?
Oh my God. Pension funds are just stuffed with private equity, private credit. And even on the retail side, I think one of the online platforms up in Canada, they started selling private credit credit fund recently. And again, and the big deal with private equity and credit, there's no mark to market because there's no real market. It's what you think it might be. So, you know, the health of pension funds, I would argue that when we get the downturn that will eventually come up, you would either see them, hey, they have to accurately price, you know, their private investments, or they don't, but they may not be as healthy as what they claim to be. Again, there's no way to, because we talked about the article last week, it was a Bloomberg article. I think it was like, as an example, one piece of a private credit piece, one fund was pricing it at 40 cents on the dollar and somebody else was at 90 cents on the dollar. So I remember years ago back in Bermuda, you know, was at the, you know, when a research meeting was really the pub, you know, after work. And we're chatting with this guy there, who's one of the funds on the island, and you know, say, hey, like, we know this one bank has this, you know, this mortgage-backed security. And this guy said, yeah, he said, you know, on the advice of Goldman, he said, Goldman is pricing it at 35 cents in the dollar. And I said, okay. I said, what's this other bank marking it at? He said, they have it marked at 98. And I said, my God, I'm shorting that guy the next morning. You know, and that's when the banks all started going under. But again, like, there's no way to correctly or accurately price a private trading security because it's, you know, what three of us agree to market at. You know, that's it. Until you had to sell it, then you realize the true value.
Sounds like a lot of shenanigans going on, just like those Canadian banks.
Well, that's what these pension funds should be after. They have a deep pool of capital. They have an infinite time horizon. If you can have an opportunity to buy a building or three square city blocks in the middle of New York or San Francisco or wherever at 10 cents on the dollar or 5 cents on the dollar or whatever, to me, that you can, I mean, that seems like a decent, like, obviously not a huge proportion of your portfolio naturally, but with the long enough time horizon, there's probably, I don't know, that seems like an attractive idea. I mean, to, you know, there's going to be desperate people and you're going to need some liquidity. Oh, we lost the boomer.
We lost the boomer.
He slipped into the water. But I just think that would be an interesting, I wonder what he would have said about that. But anyways,
we'll never know. We'll never know.
That's right.
you and I can stick analysts for the next 5-10 minutes.
Yeah, of course. But,
Rich, there was also some interesting info coming out of the ECB this week. We also had some ISM services, which I was tagging you on Twitter there. So ISM services came in a little bit softer at what, 52?
Yeah.
Still in expansionary territory. What's your kind of takeaway on that? Did that catch you by surprise? Because I know you've been watching the ISM services in terms of the outlook here for the US economy.
Yeah, for sure. I think, so first of all, it is still an expansionary territory. So if you look at, so the direction and the rate of change, so the direction was growing and the rate of change is slower. So that spooked the market a little bit. The thing that, but there's like, it's, you know, it's never just one thing. I think there was one thing that it was the new orders to me really stood out. So the new orders jumped. So that's meant to be a lead on the overall index. Who knows? I don't know if I necessarily believe that, but I guess it makes sense. Sort of the new orders grew. The thing that also spooked the market was, so on the negative side was the employment number. So the employment number fell a lot.
Is that the employment number from what, the ISM?
Yeah. Excuse me. Sorry. That's right. Because tomorrow we have non-farm payroll. Sorry. I meant the, one of the several sort of indicators that create that together create the diffusion index. So you have like new orders, for people who may not know. So you have new orders, employment, supplier deliveries, inventory, prices, backlogs, export orders, and something else I'm forgetting. And so the amalgam of that, their direction, their increase and their pace of increase or decrease is how you get sort of the ISM. You can do this for sectors, you can do this for countries, et cetera. But the employment one is an important one. New orders is important. And the employment one contracted. So that was the thing that people freaked out. I think it was a bit overdone because we've had a lot of sort of volatility in that series.
You're seeing bond yields obviously come off as a result. Starting to kind of settle back down. So the big number, I know Boomer would want us to talk about it, was the non-farm payrolls.
Yeah.
So that number is coming out tomorrow.
That's right.
And that'll probably be, I mean, that's probably as widely watched as almost some of the CPI inflation data, no?
Yeah, it's obviously depending on what part of the cycle you're in. But tomorrow, that's going to be a huge number. Huge is in very important. It's expected to be 200, which is actually quite punchy. Remember, it's always about the increase or decrease relative to expectations. So that's always sort of, and then there's always
so 200. 200 is the consensus estimate here.
Yeah. And last month it was like 350 something. I can't remember what it was, but something like that. So we'll which was really strong.
Anyone that's listening to this episode, you can Google the headline of US non-farm payrolls and see if that 200 number hit or not. But
yeah, that's right. But there's also other stuff that comes out, which is unemployment rate, participation rate, and wage growth, which is really important. So wages have been
that all
really,
tomorrow?
Really... Yeah, it's all tomorrow. It's all the sort of employment situation release. It's like you can just Google that. And Canada's also number your favorite, the random number generator is coming out tomorrow as well for Canada. So that'll be really interesting because we're seeing more and more stories of the economy unable or unwilling to absorb the influx of people. So remember, we have huge influx of working age people. So prime age is 25 to 54 or something like that, or 24 to 55 or whatever it is. We have a huge influx of people. And if your economy can absorb them, then your employment to population number, which I think in Canada is like 61%, stays flat. But we're starting to see that roll over. So that'll be interesting too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so it's a big, big data point here tomorrow. We're, of course, recording on a Thursday, but for those that are paying attention, keep an eye on that. I'm sure the bond market's going to have a big reaction, and you know, interest rate, you know, expectations moving forward will seemingly adjust. So maybe this will finally get our buddy Tiff to move off the sidelines.
There's one more thing we have to talk about, or else the boomer would be really sad, which is the outflow of money from ESG funds.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to take a little victory lap here. Fascinating how a little higher interest rates all of a sudden crystallizes people's, you know, what do I say, focus on things that are more important, which is returning money to shareholders rather than all this sort of fluffy.
What's the takeaway there? Is there any like concrete data?
Yes, there is concrete data. The way you, one of the concrete data is literally flows. So for each ETF you have, you can go on your Bloomberg and type in like ETF flow, and you can aggregate those flows. You do that for any economy, countries, and you can compare them and contrast them. And you can also do them for specific themes like tech or, you know, video games or whatever. And they sort of give you a feel for the popularity. It doesn't let you predict what's going to happen with the equity markets or the equities themselves, but definitely gives you a feel for what's dominating sort of the zeitgeist in the market. Or for example, when China a couple weeks ago, they wanted to, they tried to pressure the national team into buying local equities. You saw, literally see the numbers shoot up. So the inflow to the publicly traded ETFs sort of soared. And we're seeing sort of the opposite of that happening with ESG related funds, which is you're seeing a net outflow out of these funds because either they haven't been able to meet the lofty sort of claims that they made, either the returns are poor relative to the market. And then obviously they usually charge way, way higher fees. And so in my view, sort of the game is up. It was a marketing exercise from the beginning, and, you know, I think that's
Stephen Guilbeault is not going to be happy about that one.
No, he's not going to be happy.
Maybe we should just get the Canada pension funds to keep mandate them to buy more of that crap. But,
yeah, that's right.
That's a good place to end it. As always, guys, we appreciate the support here in the Looney Hour. If you've enjoyed this conversation at all we ask that you share this episode with at least one person and help us continue to build the Looney Hour community. And as always, we'll see you next week.